13 to 17 degrees. But through Tuesday, we will see some scattered heavy thundery downpours moving north across Northern Ireland and Scotland. Temperatures between 21 and 23 degrees. But that thundery rain clears away on Wednesday to leave brighter weather behind. That's all for now. It's back to you, Zoe.
Thanks a lot, Ben. Now on Radio 4, our new book of the week, 1913. Across Europe, relationships are foundering. Through a series of biographical extracts and contemporary news stories, we recapture the moods and the movements, artistic, social and political, of Europe in the year preceding war.
In the first days of January 1913, a slightly scruffy 34-year-old Russian arrives at Vienna's northern station from Krakow. As soon as he arrives, he boards a tram for Hietzing. His passport bears the name Stavros Papadopoulos, which is supposed to sound like a mixture of Greek and Georgian, and every border guard has let him through. Now, having arrived in Vienna, he has discarded his Georgian alias. From January 1913 onwards, he says, "My name is Stalin, Josef Stalin." When he gets out of the tram, on his right, he sees the Schönbrunn Palace, brightly lit against the dull winter grey, and the park behind it. He enters the house at 30 Schönbrunner Schlossstrasse, which is what it says on the little slip of paper that Vladimir Ilyich Lenin had given to him. And ring the bell marked Troyanov. When the maid appears, he says the agreed code word. In Prague, Dr. Franz Kafka, a clerk with the Workers' Accident Insurance Company for the Kingdom of Bohemia, in faraway Berlin, in the apartment at 29 Emanuel Kirchstrasse, Phyllis Bauer, 25, a shorthand typist with Carl Lindstrom Limited. They had met briefly in August, and since then they've been writing to each other at night while their families are asleep, hot-headed, enchanting, strange, unsettling letters, and usually another one the next afternoon. But just how quickly her distant and beloved Franz could turn into a terrible mystery, she would learn only from his New Year's letter. He evokes their mutual love, dreams that his hand and Phyllis's will be forever bound together. Before going on, however, it's always possible that a couple might once have been led to the scaffold bound together in such a way. What a thought for a prenuptial letter. They haven't even kissed. And here he is already fantasizing about their walking hand in hand to the scaffold. Kafka himself seems momentarily startled by the thought spilling from him. "But what sort of things are these pouring out of my head?" he writes. The explanation he offers is simple. It's the number 13 in the year. Gabriele D'Annunzio gives a friend a copy of his Martyrdom of St. Sebastian and in the dedication prefers to date it 1912 plus one. For Arnold Schoenberg, the friend he is giving the book to, refuses to mention the unlucky number. In Schoenberg's music, the number 13 does not occur, not even as a page number. When Schoenberg realized with horror that the title of his opera about Moses and Aaron would have 13 letters, he crossed out the second A from Aaron, and henceforth it was called Moses and Aaron. And now a whole year under the shadow of that number? Sigmund Freud, at 19 Berggasse, Vienna, is spending these January days in his study, finishing off his book on Totem and Taboo. At that moment, when Freud is developing his theory of parricide, the killing of a parent, his pupils, above all, the Zurich psychologist Jung, are challenging him. In December 1912, Jung, then 37, had written to Freud, 56. "I would like to make you aware that your technique of treating your pupils as patients is a mistake. By so doing, you are creating slavish sons. Meanwhile, you always remain comfortably on top as the father. Out of pure subservience, no one dares to tug the prophet's beard." Seldom in his life has anything hit Freud as hard as this act of parricide. He drafts a first reply, which he doesn't send, and which will only be found in his desk after his death. But on the 3rd of January, writes to Jung, "Your letter is unanswerable. I therefore propose that we abandon our private relationship entirely. I will lose nothing, because I have long been joined to you only by the thin thread of the further development of past disappointments." Jung replies on the 6th of January, "I will comply with your wish to abandon the personal relationship. Besides, you will probably know better than anyone what this moment means for you." Jung writes that in ink. Then he adds by typewriter, and it looks like a tombstone for one of the great intellectual friendships of the 20th century, "The rest is silence." The Austrian figure skater Alois Lutz spun so skillfully in the air on a deep frozen lake in that bitter cold January that the jump bears the name Lutz to this day. Every afternoon, Ernst Ludwig Kirchner boards the newly built underground train to Potsdamer Platz. The other painters of Die Brüche, Erich Haeckel, Otto Muller, Carl Schmidt-Rottluff, had moved to Berlin with Kirchner from Dresden, that wonderfully forgotten Baroque city where the group was founded. They were a community in every respect, sharing paints and women, but Berlin, that pounding mental overload of a capital city, turns them into individuals and cuts away the bridges connecting them. In Berlin, they threaten to founder. But in his early 30s, Kirchner comes into his own in the city. His art is urban, raw, his figures are overstretched, and his drawing style as frantic and aggressive as the city itself. He is drawn to Aschinger's restaurant, where you can spend all day if you've bought a bowl of soup. So Kirchner sits there and looks and draws and looks. The winter day is already drawing to a close. The noise in the square is deafening. It's the busiest square in Europe, and passing in front of him are the city's main arteries, where you will see horse-drawn carts delivering barrels, side by side with the first high-class automobiles and the droschkes, the horse-drawn cabs, trying to dodge the piles of horse droppings. Several tram lines traverse the big square. The huge space rings with a mighty metallic scrape each time a tram leans into the curve. And in among them, people, people, people all running as if their lives depended on it. Above them, billboards singing the praises of sausages, eau de cologne, and beer. And beneath the arcades, the elegantly dressed ladies of the night, the only ones barely moving in the square, like spiders on the edge of a web. The striking aspect is their huge hats, bizarre, towering constructions with feathers under the streetlights, whose green gaslight is lit when early winter evening falls. That pale green glow on the faces of the prostitutes in Potsdamer Platz, and the raging noises of the city behind them, are what Kirchner wants to turn into art, into paintings. In Wilmersdorf, 14 Durlacherstrasse, second floor, Kirchner has made a burrow for himself, nearly every inch hung with oriental carpets, stuffed with figures and masks from Africa and Oceania, and Japanese parasols, as well as his own sculptures, his own furniture, his own paintings. Photographs of Kirchner from those days show him either naked or wearing a black suit and tie, his high-collared shirt snow-white, his cigarette held as limply in his hand as if he were Oscar Wilde. Always by his side, Erna Schilling, his beloved, a new woman, with a free spirit beneath a pageboy haircut, the spitting image of Kafka's Felice Bauer. Kirchner had met Erna and her sister, Gerda Schilling, a year before at a Berlin dance hall. He first stepped out with 19-year-old Gerda, later with 28-year-old Erna, and in between, with both.
There is a glorious painting from these days. On the left, three naked women soliciting. On the right, the artist in his studio, cigarette in his mouth, checking the women out like a connoisseur. That's how he likes to see himself. Judgment of Paris, he writes in black paint on the back of the canvas. 1913. Ernst Ludwig Kirchner.
The drug ecstasy has been synthesized for the first time. The patent application drags on through 1913. Then it's completely forgotten about for several decades. Marcel Proust sits in his study at 102 Boulevard Haussmann in Paris, building his cage. Neither sunlight, nor dust, nor noise must bother him while he's working. He has hung his study with three layers of curtains and papered his walls with cork panels. In this soundproofed room of the mind, trying his hand at a novel about memory and the search for lost time, the first part would be called A Love of Swans, and in fine ink he writes the final sentence down on paper. The reality I once knew no longer exists. The memory of a particular image is the melancholy remembering of a particular moment. And houses, streets, avenues are fleeting. Oh, the years. Stalin will stay in Vienna for 4 weeks. His next foreign trip of any length will be 30 years later to Tehran, where he will take part in discussions with Churchill and Roosevelt. Stalin rarely leaves his secret hideaway at 30 Schönbrunner Schlossstrasse, the home of the Troyanovskys. He is completely preoccupied with writing his essay, Marxism and the National Question, commissioned by Lenin. Only very occasionally, early in the afternoon, does he stretch his legs in the nearby park at Schönbrunn Palace, which lies cold and neat in the January snow. Once a day, there's a moment of excitement when Kaiser Franz Josef leaves the palace and sets off in his coach to do a spot of governing. Stalin walks through the park, thinking. It's already getting dark. Then another walker comes towards him, 23 years old, a failed painter who's been turned down by the Academy and who is now killing time in the men's hostel on Meldmannstrasse. His name is Adolf Hitler. The two men, whose friends at the time say they like to walk in the park at Schönbrunn, may have greeted one another politely and tipped their hats as they made their way through the boundless park. Even when Hitler and Stalin sealed their pact in 1939, they never met. So they were never closer than they were on one of those bitterly cold afternoons in the park of Schönbrunn Palace. Missing person notice. Lost. Leonardo's Mona Lisa. She was stolen from the Louvre in 1911. Still no clues. Picasso is questioned by the Paris police, but he has an alibi, and they let him go home. In the Louvre, French mourners lay bouquets against the bare wall.
"1913, the Year Before the Storm" was written by Florian Lies, abridged by Pete Nichols and read by Michael Maloney. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. The shipping forecast is next here on Radio 4, but before that, it's this. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday the 23rd of July.